Richard, they talked about stimulus of science and the injection of vast amounts of money. Is it a reality that you put this money in and it doesn't just get spent in the sky? It does turn into tangible asset value here on Earth?
Oh, absolutely. You can actually look. There is evidence, direct evidence, that the Apollo program stimulated education, stimulated the PhD, stimulated technology, all sorts of reasons why it was a good thing. The tragedy was that it wasn't really a giant leap. It was a step and then a step back, because we're not there now. We don't have a moon base. We don't have any of this stuff. But there are still people who are inspired by Apollo, very much so. Young tech entrepreneurs. I was talking to one the other day in Los Angeles. He's started up a new company and has commissioned an artist to do a full-size picture of a lunar lander on the wall of the building where the lunar lander was originally built, because that's where they are. That's where they set their tech company up. And they are inspired by these guys.
But were they inspired as much as that amount of money could buy you if you just inspired scientists to develop things here on Earth?
Well, I think the danger is you can get into this, oh, we could do this or we could do that. It's a ludicrous argument, because we can have healthcare, we can have education, we can have science on Earth, and we can do space stuff. And if you start getting into the, oh, we only do space stuff because it will produce Teflon or it'll produce, you know, better materials. There are so many reasons to do it. And you can draw an economic case for it. You can draw up a technological case for it. But I think the real case is aspiration, inspiration, and the fact that these people who walked on the moon, these missions, these amazing people who went to the moon are still inspiring people today and still inspiring entrepreneurs today. Well, that justifies it in my mind.
And David Bowie songs are more popular than ever.
Well, indeed, yeah.
And Jill, are we seeing, do you think, a sort of space race Mark II now? And is that a good thing?
I don't want to downplay the significance of the scientific achievements during that time, and certainly it was inspirational, but I don't think it's worth whitewashing the geopolitics of the first space race. A lot of people don't realize that before the United States decided to land on the moon, they thought about bombing it instead. Also, the day that they left the plaque that said, "We came in peace and all mankind," it was the height of the Vietnam War. And so politics was very much a driver at that time. And it's worth keeping that in mind, if only because it helps us think about how we're going to continue space exploration and exploitation in the future. So we need to sort of remind ourselves that is part of the history. Is that repeating itself now? I'm uncomfortable with using the direct analogy of a second space race for a couple of reasons. The main one being that it's a different landscape now. In the 60s and the 70s, it was primarily states that were acting in outer space, that were entities who had space capabilities. And we've seen a diversification of the types of actors that we have in outer space, not only there being more spacefaring countries, but we have private actors, we have individuals, and also a complicated blending of these actors. So rarely is it just a state government that has these capabilities. And so it's an awkward analogy in my mind, and I don't think it does us much good to sort of superimpose that narrative because it sets us up for a potential vision of competition that might not necessarily be there. Having said that, politics is behind it. And there is going to be a level of prestige related to making strides in this direction.
But who owns Mars?
Well, exactly. I was just going to say, I mean, as we know from the first treaty that was established over outer space in the 1960s, which is widely respected, nobody owns any part of outer space. It's the common heritage of mankind. And no country, well, that's part of the problem. It specifies that no country can lay claim to a celestial body, but we can presume that that will apply to private companies eventually as well. But
so if Ryan ends up being the first one there, will Ryan be king of Mars?
Absolutely not. He can be a squatter, but he cannot own it. And I think it's interesting that countries have nonetheless managed to place flags on the moon, not just the United States, but five other countries. And so there's clearly a political significance in landing on these planets, but it doesn't imply ownership.
Ryan, are you comfortable with that? You're not going to be crowned anytime soon.
Well, I think increasingly what we're going to see is collaboration in space in the future, because no one nation will be able to afford something as insane in terms of the cost as terraforming, which would cost around at least $1 trillion to be able to do. So we're going to see public-private partnerships working together in order to make this happen. We're already seeing with private companies supplying the International Space Station that they're driving down the costs. And we've just seen recently, actually, that it looks like Europe and Russia are looking to team up together to enable a moon base eventually. So I'm very optimistic about the future. It's no longer a race, it's a cooperative endeavour.
Just asking a personal question for a minute. Are you not uncomfortable with the prospect that you wouldn't come back?
No, I think that's part of the main reason. It's the attraction.
Is it really that bad here on Earth?
I know
funding in science is a struggle, and you know, and this is probably one way to surmount that, but really?
No. I think it makes sense doing a one-way trip for the first way to do it. You can make the economic case that it's cheaper, you get more return also. But I think the inspirational factor of having a group of four people from four different continents representing everyone, conducting scientific research on the surface, leaving a lasting legacy as opposed to just going there, collecting some rocks and bringing them back. I certainly hope that we could bring some rocks back, but I, for one, would want to stay there for the rest of my life to maximise the impact that I can leave behind for everyone back here on the Earth.
Carolyn, would you go?
No.
Is it just because it's an inhospitable place? Or because, I mean, as a space scientist, you don't feel the same allure?
No, it's because I think I know a bit too much about Mars and know that I probably would not enjoy being on the surface. I'd love to see it, don't get me wrong. But I've kind of got too much invested here on Earth by now. I think I'm quite happy to stay put.
Today we've discussed just some of the many arguments for and against a trip to Mars, but in the end it looks like we're probably going to go anyway, be it through government organisations or private companies. And in fact, scheduled from the 27th to the 30th of October, NASA have workshops to discuss potential landing sites for a human Mars mission. So Sanjeev, what's that all about?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So next week there's a meeting in Houston where it's the first really serious look at examination of potential human landing sites and what they call exploration zones. It's a three-day meeting and they're going to be starting, people are putting forward proposed landing sites, exploration zones, not only to consider what you can do scientifically at these sites, you know, what geological problems you can solve, you know, the history of Mars, you know, habitability, discovering ancient life, but also to look for resources that colonies on Mars could survive on. So it's both a scientific and an engineering endeavour. So, you know, scientists and engineers over the next, over 3 days next week are going to be presenting and discussing this potential. And that really sets the process going. You know, the idea is that potentially NASA would be sending humans to Mars in the 2030s. But we need to start building the science case and developing the engineering skills required to be able to do that.
Thank you, Sanjeev. That's Sanjeev Gupta. And thank you also this week to Carolyn Crawford, Ryan McDonald, Richard Hollingham and Jill Stewart for joining us on our panel. Thank you also to Connie Orbach for production. Join us next week when we'll be firmly back on planet Earth, exploring the new world of electric vehicles. And we'll find out what happens when a naked scientist gets his hands on a Tesla electric supercar and a top-of-the-range Merc sports car. The Naked Scientist comes to you from Cambridge University. It's supported by the STFC, the EPSRC and Rolls-Royce. I'm Chris Smith, and thank you very much for listening.